Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Where are we?
We're pretty much G-spot Cotswolds. So just up the road is Bybury, very popular with Japanese tourists. Apparently, the local story is that many moons ago, a Japanese emperor or somebody from the royal family came to the UK and visited Bybury. And he thought it was so special that it's now in Japanese folklore. So if you're in Japan, you grow up learning about Bybury. So we'll cycle through it and you'll see it's mayhem.
And who are you?
Me? Well, I'm Dr. Cool these days. I got an honorary doctorate a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Cool, that's a Bond villain's name, isn't it?
But what do? You're not really a Bond villain.
I'm a professional mountaineer, professional mountain guide. And I specialise on Everest.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
When you went out to get your bike, my wife leans across and says, he's quite good looking, isn't he?
Keep this in. Yeah. This can stay in.
A bit disturbing. She's done that a few times recently. Had a friend of mine, Johannes.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a...
He sounds dangerous.
Well, he's a personal trainer, so he's a trainer to one of the... he's from LA. He was brought up in New York, lives in LA, and he's a personal trainer to one of the tennis pros. So he's over in for Wimbledon. His man gets knocked out third round or something like that. So he comes to stay for a couple of nights. Jazz comes in from the gym, and in her own words, this Greek Adonis was stood in my kitchen.
You need to pick your friends more carefully.
Yeah.
And the interviews you agree to. How did you go from being in High Wycombe to being high up in the Himalayas? How did it all start? How did you get into mountaineering?
So, I was basically living just outside Uxbridge in Middlesex. I was actually in a little place called Denham.
End of the tube line, really?
Yeah. So we were actually living in Denham. And one of my good friends at school I knew climbed, he had a very adventurous father. I mean, my father was scout leader and big into the outdoors, but my father didn't climb or anything like that. My father introduced me to this sort of landscape and being out in the woods and not being self-sufficient, but making shelters and dens and fires and things like that. But Andy Fowkes, he's quite a big rider. Cat 1, I think, Cat 2 maybe. Anyway,
wow.
Andy's dad was like a professional rally driver, among other things, and was climbed. And the boys, Andy and his brother Roger, used to go down Brunel University climbing.
They have a climbing wall there?
Climbing wall there. Very early climbing wall. And I just plucked up the courage one day and said, you know, can I come? And I loved it. I was a hockey player really before that. I used to play hockey to a relatively good level.
You climbed trees as a boy, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I grew up on the corner of a farm field. Little wooden bungalow, but no mains drainage, no central heating. You used to have a little oil fire, wood burning stove to heat the water. My father was unemployed for quite a lot of my teenage years, so we had no money. So, you know, what we're seeing here, it's all farmland, was my playground.
Yeah.
Used a holiday every year, same place in West Wales.
Your only child, brothers and sisters?
Got a younger sister. Yeah, so, you know, there weren't any flash holidays or toys or stuff like that, and we used to entertain ourselves by basically being kicked out the back door. So I've always had quite a passion for being outdoors and camping and staying overnight in dens or climbing trees, like you said. But the climbing came about 17, 18. Spoke to Andy. We started rock climbing down on the south coast in Dorset, Swanage. And then between A-levels and university, four of us went off to the Alps and somehow survived an alpine season. And kind of learned as we went along, which was somewhat dangerous.
I was going to say, yeah.
But, you know, we lived to tell the tale, and I was fully bitten by the bug.
Yeah.
Went to Leeds University, very active climbing club there. Super active, a lot of enthusiasm. And then more recently, I had the total honour of going back for an honorary doctorate. So I was up there on graduation day. It's a new installation of a chancellor.
Yeah.
Dame Professor Jane Francis, who was one of my lecturers when I was at uni there.
What did you study?
Geology.
Yeah. Of course, rocks.
Rocks and minerals. Yeah, so she's a new chancellor, and she bestowed upon me an honorary doctorate.
Brilliant, what a thrill.
Amazing. I know it's pomp and ceremony, but it was a beautiful day, and it's my university. And to go back there, it was so wonderful.
But after you graduated the first time, did you go into the world of real work, or did you know at that point, I'm going to go straight into
imagining? I came out of Leeds, didn't really know what I wanted to do. And it always surprises me, I look back on that and think, well, so many people come out of uni and they head straight to finance or start doing accountancy exams with whoever it may be, Deloitte or whoever.
Yeah.
I just think, how do you know that? I came out of university, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I think partly because I was very naive and I lived in this fantasy land of climbing, which for me was everything.
Did you know you were good at it?
No, I shit at it. I'm not a good climber, really. I've been lucky enough that, I think it was Carnegie once said, I was clever enough to surround myself with people cleverer than I. And I've been blessed with climbing with some of the world's very best climbers.
But they would say you're one of those.
I'm a yes man. Ask me to do something, I'm like a golden Labrador. Yes, I'll do that. Involves lots of suffering, I don't care. I'm good at grinding it out. Like a bike, I'm not good in the hills. I'm not punchy, I'm not a sprinter. I grind miles out. And I think if you throw yourself into the mountains enough, and if you've got the technical know-how and the knowledge, then you grind out what the general public would call success, i.e. getting to the top of mountains.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really success. Success coming home. But you do it enough, it's going to stick somewhere. That's what I did. I'm good at putting up with hardship. There can't be a climber, or arguably even a red-blooded human being, who's into adventure, that at some stage hasn't dreamed or thought about or would like to go to Everest. Friends of mine come back and said, oh, I'm a climber. Can't think of anything worse. Queues and fixed ropes, and you lean on a Sherpa for support. Doesn't interrupt. Look at the view.
Stunning,
isn't it? But until you actually go there and experience it, I don't think you're in a position to cast judgment.
No.
You can go and climb Mont Blanc and it's busy. You can climb Ben Nevis and it's busy. These are honeypot mountains.
Yes.
But it's Everest we're talking about. And I would challenge my friends who criticise me by saying, okay, here's a free trip to Everest. So, the clients I work with, I've genuinely been working with them for two and a half, three years. And we go to other parts of the world, we climb in the Alps, we forge a meaningful relationship. So by the time we go there, we're friends. Now, it's not a transactional thing. And a lot of the criticism, and the rightly so criticism on the mountain, is when people essentially just buy into teams.
Yes.
There's no collective spirit, there's no culture, there's no common vision because it's everybody for themselves. And I try to avoid that, and I do avoid it. I'm not interested in that transactional relationship. I want to be able to laugh and cry and celebrate with my clients, who are my friends and my Sherpa team. And we have one common vision and goal. And we are a collective and we do work together. Rather than a hodgepodge of random people who buy onto a trip and come together and meet perhaps for the first time in Kathmandu or even in base camp and are expected to form bonds and look after one another. It doesn't work like that.
What was it though that got you hooked on it that first time? What was the thing about it?
I think I find open spaces gives me a sense of well-being, of meaning, of belonging.
Yeah.
And I grew up on the corner of a farm field, like I said, and we always had space. And I spent some time in London, I found it incredibly claustrophobic. And you can't see the horizon, and there's people all around you. And all of a sudden I found myself on sea cliffs or in the Scottish Highlands or in the Alps, or very quickly I went to the Himalayas. I organized my first Himalayan trip when I was 19. And it's that sense of, well, that's reality.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. Sense of wonder at it, the natural beauty of it.
Yeah, a little bit.
The perspective
and
it gives you.
And also the clutter of Western society life is stripped back. You're sort of concerned about, on an expedition, you're concerned about the weather, you're concerned about your hydration, and your nutrition and your shelter.
Yeah.
And that's about it. I think in the West, our society, we try to quantify too much. Now, it doesn't matter if we climb 14, 15, 16 times. I mean, like, who cares? You know, it's the quality of the ascent and the quality of the journey. You know, the conditions are different, the wind's different, the weather's different, the client, I've always been there with a client, or bar 2013. There's all the different little nuances. Sometimes being there with film guys, sometimes I haven't. So it is always different. And it keeps you on your toes. And it's beautiful. And people always say, well, Jesus, why don't you go climb other mountains? Well, why don't you do this? But it's twofold or threefold. Partly it's work. Everest is a honeypot mountain, for better or for worse. And it is my sort of given for cash earning for the year, because I can plan around that.
Yes.
Two, I love working there with my Sherpa friends. The Sherpas are such a nice race of people, so generous and kind and hardworking. So, you know, you got that. And then I love it. I utterly love working on Everest.
This is something that others have talked about. Ben Saunders, you know, the poet explorer.
Right. Yeah, and it's very telling, and you know, Ben, I'm sure Ben will say the same. You know, you come back to this sort of whiz way of life here, and it's somewhat overpowering to start with.
Yeah.
Then the noise, and not the physicality of the noise, but just the noise around, the noise of life. It's quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
Suffocating. And you don't get that on an expedition.
So why not move to the mountains permanently?
Well, I did for a while. I lived in Chamonix for 6-7 years, but I found it was the same shit, different place. You know, only now all the correspondence and the shit was in French, not English. And I can't speak or write or read French. And it was interesting, I moved back from France in 2008-09, and the following year I was back out working. So flew over for like 2 or 3 weeks to do some work. I still got a house over there. And all of a sudden, I think I appreciated the mountains again. I think for my 6-7 years living there, they're on your doorstep. You begin to take them for granted.
Yeah.
And that's wrong.
So you need that distance.
I think I do.
Ready to pop the question?
The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And the other thing that I found very quickly with trips, I was 19, organised a trip to Pakistan. Yeah, I'd never really been out of Europe. And all of a sudden we're in Pakistan, and it's a very different place. Very different place to anywhere I'd ever been before. I got violently ill. The climbing was on a different scale, and we did a new route. So climbed a line which nobody ever done before.
Wow!
On a sub 6,000 meter peak, so not massively high, but
it's still
pretty
hard.
Yeah, pretty high. I mean, much higher than anything in Europe. And we'd gone up one way. We'd have come off the back of the mountain, and then had to walk all the way back round to base camp. So like a 2-day walk.
Oh my God!
Do you have enough fuel?
Oh no way!
No, we ran out of food and fuel.
So dangerous.
No, it's just walking all round in the valley. And we come out of the snow line into a high alpine meadows, beautiful. And you get bombarded with the smell of life.
Yeah.
The smell of grass and, just life.
Yeah.
And it's an explosion to the senses. Anyway, we're walking through the meadow. It's three of us. And up ahead, you can see this figure going sort of lolloping up the hillside towards us. We're like, oh, what's going on here? And man, or boy really, probably 16, 17.
Yeah.
With a shepherd's crook or some description. And he's a goat herder. And he's kind of shouting and waving at us, and we don't quite know what to do.
Is he happy? Is he smiling?
Can't tell.
Okay.
I thought he was going to be quite aggressive. But we're too tired to run away, and there's nowhere to run to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this dude's wearing rags. Can't speak a word of English. We can't speak a word of Urdu, I think it was. And just through pointing, hand gestures, pulling on shirts, basically he invites us back to his yurt. And this kid's got nothing. He's up there all summer. Now, remember, I'm 19.
Yeah.
Grew up in Denham. Quite an affluent area. We had no money, but it was an affluent area. And we weren't middle class. We were on the poverty line when I was growing up. But in the greater schemes of world poverty, even those who are poor sin here.
Yes.
They're not poor.
No.
And there's this kid who has nothing. And a filthy old yurt thing, and he shared absolutely everything with us.
And was he on his own? He lived on his own?
He was on his own. He's up there for the summer.
Wow.
Summer pasture land. Almost certainly illiterate. I'm guessing, but, And he shared everything that he had, which was basically nothing. Turn right just around the corner here. And in an instant, I think I fell in love with the people of the Himalayas. And you see it time and time again. Doesn't matter whether it's in Bhutan, which is basically the far east of the Himalayas, Nepal, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, you see the same generosity of people that have nothing.
Yeah.
And their deep, ingrained community spirit and how friendly they are and how welcoming they are. And then you come back to London Heathrow and you're thrown back into what we deem to be a cultured society. It makes you question everything. We've only got one go at this poxy little silly thing called life. And it's a cliche, but we're not going to come back. I don't know if you're religious. I don't know if you're listeners are particularly religious. No, I'm not either. No, I don't believe in reincarnation or second go or all that sort of thing. And I don't believe that the pearly gates are going to give us anything beyond death. So if we don't die with a big smile on our face, knowing that we've lived life in whatever form that may be, because it's a very individual thing, we're not going to have another go. Death in the mountains is often very lonely, very slow, unless of course you fall off, and leaves people with lots of questions. So it's very selfish, I think, to die that way. Whereas, you know, if you pass away gently after hopefully a very short illness or maybe even no illness, you know, you don't leave those unanswered questions of wife, family, friends, or whoever it is. You know, there's no Saffron saying, "Mummy, just tell me again what happened to Daddy." Mm-hmm. Because Saffron will know what happened to Daddy. Daddy didn't sort of succumb to lack of oxygen and die lonely in a tent on his own at 7,500 meters on, you know, the flanks of whatever mountain it is.
Have you had any close scrapes?
Yeah, of course you do. You know, everything from avalanches to rockfall to exhaustion.
What's the closest you've been to death?
Yeah, we're in Pakistan years ago, so this would have been 99 maybe, 97. And we're trying a massive unclimbed ridgeline. And I was leading out ahead. So I was sort of fixing the rope and we had a fixed line with us. And I just remember looking up and we're hearing something and looking up and the sky was full of falling rocks.
Whoa.
And it was quite steep terrain that I was on. So not sort of terrain that you could dodge about. You just got to freeze, come in close to the rock and just hope that they miss you. Try and get as much protection you can from your helmet. I know it sounds ridiculous, but you just try and make yourself small.
Yes.
And these rocks impacted all around me. One in between my arm and my face. And I was left with the smell of cordite in the air. And somehow they'd all missed me. But the rope, there was a rope which I had, which I literally just tied off to an anchor point. That rope had been decimated. No. It's just taken the fixed line, which I'd fixed with the other boys, to come up away. I mean, A, it could have taken me off. B, one of my teammates could have been climbing up the rope. You talked Juma up the rope. It was very hard climbing we were doing.
Yeah.
Juma up the rope. He could have been on that rope and he would have died. And it's just, it's total Russian roulette. Right. There's nothing we could have done to predict that or avoid that. That is objective danger.
What personal ambitions do you have left to do? Because you did Nuptse Everest Lhotse, or was it the other way around, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly that.
Which was for yourself?
Yeah, well, it was for myself, but it was a snatched opportunity. I had a client no-show on Everest.
And for those who aren't aware, and I'm not sure I even am, Lhotse and Nuptse, what's their relationship to Everest?
So
are they like
Everest
on the shoulder of Everest?
Yeah, you got Everest. And on the south side, there's a hidden valley, the Western Coombe. And that Coombe is bounded by the three mountains. Everest, at the end of the Coombe, you've got Lhotse, which is the fourth highest mountain in the world, first climbed by the Austrians in 55. And then you've got Nuptse, 19th highest mountain in the world. First climbed by the Brits, actually, in the 60s, with the one very young, it was a British army expedition, with a very young Chris Bonington.
Huh.
And people had climbed all three. I think only two people had climbed all three, maybe three people climbed all three. And then what we did, or what I did, is basically chain them. So they'd climb one after the other.
Yeah.
In quick succession. We actually did it in a week. Well, I did it in a week. Base camp to base camp. So, yeah, it was pretty full on. We were very lucky with the weather.
And so how do you top that? Will you do something along those lines again?
So for a couple of years, we tried to get off the ground, get funding for what I called... So the first one's called the Everest Triple Crown. So Everest, Lhotse and or Three Peaks. You've got no sort of tongue-in-cheek to Three Peaks in the UK.
Okay.
And then afterwards, I thought, well, you know, actually, I'm quite good at this high altitude lark. So I tried to get funding to go and do Everest, Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain in the world, and K2, and do them back to back.
So 1, 2, 3, or 3, 2, 1.
Over a period of about 3 months.
Wow.
But I couldn't get the funding together. It looked like Land Rover at one stage was all over it, and then Brexit came along and sort of shot that in the foot. And it's kind of fizzled a little bit. And now a buddy of mine, he's got a client to fund it for him. So a buddy of mine's going to attempt it next year. No one's ever really attempted it.
And can I just say, my mind is full of images of the Himalayas, but right now we're cycling past the most manicured dry stone walls I think I've ever seen in my life.
Well, honestly, we get along here and it will open out towards the Windrush River, and it's to die for.
What's this, a chicken farm or something?
I'm not sure. I passed this the other day. They're chickens, I think, or maybe turkeys or something like that.
There's a definite funk in the air of poultry.
Yeah, what I quite like about it, it's
relatively... Turkeys, you can see them.
Relatively open, look.
Red turkey, are they them?
So they've got quite a lot of room to run around, those turkeys.
Yeah, until Christmas.
Well, yes.
How long do you think you'll go on for with the climbing? Just until you drop, as long as you don't drop off a mountain?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you can always tone things down. I mean, it doesn't have to be Everest or... some of the old Zermatt guides are in their 70s and still guiding the Matterhorn. Chris Bonington climbed the old Mount of Hoy on his 80th birthday.
Oh. And that's no mean feat, and that's quite a technical climb, isn't it, the old Mount of Hoy?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit.
It's a stack in the sea, if people don't know.
It was the BBC's first outside live broadcast.
Yes, someone climbing. It was Chris Bonington.
Bonington. Yeah. Bonington and Tom Patey and people. So
the thing is, you say old Mount of Hoy to people listening to a cycling podcast and they'll think you mean Chris. Do people often think that you made your own name up because it just sounds too good to be true for a mountaineer?
Yeah.
And it is genuine.
It is a genuine name. So what it is, the Cool, C-O-O-L.
And who wouldn't want to be called Cool, by the way? Who wouldn't want to be?
Well, think about my wife, Jazzy. Jazzy Cool.
That's her name. I would buy that album.
Jazzy Cool. So another combine. Check it out, combine. They work harder.
They do.
So the Cool, my grandfather, had a Germanic name. So we're four generations from being a German family. And my grandfather, who was born in London, a German father, had a surname of Kuhl, K-U-H-L-E, with umlauts. And living in London with a Germanic name in the Second World War.
Not cool.
Not cool, yeah. So it's changed by depot, and anything that associated the family with Germany was thrown into a small brook stream by Paddington Station.
Oh, really? Literally?
So great-grandfather's Iron Cross, all those things. Anything that associated the family with Germany was destroyed. And then, so that's where the Cool came from. And then Kenton, my parents were avid BBC Four Archers fans.
Okay.
And one of the main characters in the Archers is Shula Archer, and her brother is Kenton Archer. And that's where they first heard the name.
Are they still in it? They can't be in it still.
I think Shula might still be. Kenton's been and gone a few times, a bit like Dirty Den in EastEnders. He was a bit of a bad boy.
Yeah.
But that's where they first heard the name. And they liked it. So yeah, there we are, Kenton Cool.
It's hard not to like. Do you like it?
Growing up, it wasn't the best.
Why?
Well, anything that sets you apart when you're a child, you get ridiculed for, don't you? So, you think you're cool and be taking out a bag and giving a bit of shoeing. But then as you get older, I work in the service industry. You know, anything that sets you apart has got to be good.
Yeah.
Does it ever get shortened to Kent or Kenny or?
I get called KC a lot.
KC?
Yeah.
So then that begs questions about the Sunshine Band and.
Well, absolutely. Daddy, daddy, cool. Children like singing that a lot. Certain people from certain eras know me as different things. And you know, that's pretty cool, I think. As you meander your way through life and you meet different people at different periods of your life, you know, having different nicknames or names, I think it's pretty cool.
It is cool. You are cool in name and in nature. You are Dr. Cool. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure, man.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.